Welcome to the Savvy Dentist Podcast with Dr. Jesse Green, the show where great dentistry meets great business. Listen in each week as we bring you an inspiring person who will share their story, ideas, and business techniques to help you create a practice and a life you love. And now introducing your host, Dr. Jesse Green.
Hello everyone, Jesse Green here. Welcome back to SavvyDentist.com and to the Savvy Dentist Podcast. It's wonderful to have you company for another episode of the show. Now, I have some exciting news for you. Recently at Savvy Dentist, we've been working on a bit of a top secret project, and it's been an idea that I've actually had rattling around my head for 6 or 7 years, ever since we started the podcast. And for the longest time, it's kind of sat in the recesses of my mind until recently, where we decided to dust off the idea and bring it out. And of course, I'm referring to the launch of the Savvy Dentist magazine. The magazine is something that we're really proud of. The first edition has just been launched. We released it to our Practice Max members a week or so ago, and we're now releasing it to the general dental public. And the magazine is entirely free, and so it's there for you to, you know, absorb and to read and to hopefully learn from. And we've got some wonderful contributors there. We have accountants, we have wealth creation, we have lawyers in there sharing their insights around the payroll tax, changes that are coming down the pipeline. We have property experts in there talking about property selection. We're going to be talking about fit outs and designs for dental practices. And of course, we're going to be talking about marketing, HR team, and everything in between. Anything that you need to think about when it comes to running a business, this is going to cover it for you. There's no clinical information in this magazine. It is designed to be exclusively around the topic of business. And we also bring in other business luminaries from outside the profession to share their insights and experiences as well. And so we're super excited about this magazine, and it's totally free. And as I said, we wanted to make it accessible to as many people so that they can go on their journey to create a practice that they love and ultimately a life that they love. And so the magazine will be available from edition 2 in print version as well as a digital version. So if you want the print or the digital version, it's entirely free. It's yours as our gift to you. And all you need to do is head across to SavvyDentist.com/magazine and grab yourself a copy. Just subscribe to that and we'll make sure we get that into your hands for you very, very easily. Now, my guest today is Matt Watkinson, and Matt's the author of several books. He's actually authored 3 books. The first one is all around the principles, the 10 principles behind great customer experiences. His second book, which was called The Grid, the decision-making tool for every business, including yours. And his third book, which is what we really spoke about today, is called Mastering Uncertainty. We live in an inherently uncertain world, and yes, there's all manner of events happening at the moment that create uncertainty, but what we have to realize is that anything in the future, so anything from this moment on, is inherently uncertain. And we have to become comfortable with the idea that making decisions in an uncertain world is going to have, you know, some successes from time to time, but equally some failures. And we need to become really comfortable with that relationship with uncertainty. And Matt's worked with, you know, all manner of organizations from the FBI all the way through to Microsoft and entrepreneurial organizations in between all that. And his hypothesis is that success is correlated to your relationship or how comfortable you are with uncertainty. So in this conversation, we're going to explore what that means. We're going to talk about what uncertainty actually is. We're going to talk about the biases that we all have. We're going to talk about why we seek certainty and how we fall prey to marketing messages, you know, laden with certainty, and how that's not necessarily true. And we're going to talk about decision-making and planning and the value of that, even if we know that the future is uncertain. And so this is a wide-ranging conversation. It's really fascinating, really interesting. And it's one of those conversations where I think you'll just want to listen to a few times through, because Matt shares some really good insights. I'm also going to share with you there are a couple of expletives in this episode. And so, if that's going to bother you, then please just tune out. But I think if you can get through that, you're going to find it's just laced with gold. It's a really in-depth conversation, very thought-provoking. And it's not one of those conversations where you're going to have, you know, 3 simple steps to A, B, and C. I think what I like about this is it's encouraging us to think, and it's encouraging us to understand that there's many paths to success. There's many ways to be right. And, you know, we just got to find our path. And I hope you enjoy this conversation, because I really enjoyed recording it for you. So without any further ado, here's Matt Watkinson. Hey, Matt, welcome to the Savvy Dentist Podcast, an Englishman all the way in Los Angeles. What's the story, mate?
Halfway to Australia.
Halfway, yeah. Only a few more hours, you'll be there.
And the best way, I think, I much prefer to go via LA if I'm going to Australia than the other way. I always try and convince my friends in Australia that if they're going to England, I'm lobbying. I would like to see, I've got a lot of close friends in Australia and I'd like to see more of them. So I moved to LA almost 10 years ago. Now for a variety of reasons, one of which is being, you know, kind of design obsessed and working in the realm of UX, UI design and customer experience at the time, you know, it really felt to me like everything was emanating from California. And I was just, you know, ready for a bit of a change of scene. You know, I never lived more than 20 miles from where I was born. And I grew up in the English countryside pretty much. And then moved to Los Angeles, which was a bit of a shock.
I was going to say, in for a penny, in for a pound, right? If you're going to make a change, make a big one. That's from the English countryside to LA is almost like, you know, polar opposite, I'd imagine. So
they are not the same place.
Matt, you've written a number of books and I'm interested about all of them, but in particular your third book, which is called Mastering Uncertainty, which I know you co-authored. What was it about uncertainty that caught your attention? What was it that made you think this is the right book at the moment to be spending my time writing and laboring over? What's the background there?
What's the best way of answering that? Each of the books I've written, so I've written three books, is kind of trying to put the capstone on things I've learned in different phases of life. It's kind of like cleaning up the apartment and then locking the door and handing it to the realtor or the next tenant.
Yep.
Like that's what it's like writing a book. You then pass it on to the next person who gets to benefit from it, right? Or experience the value from it. So my first book, The 10 Principles Behind Great Customer Experiences, I think it's fairly evident what it's about. Mm. But the whole idea was, look, if we're trying to create a great experience for our customers, principles are going to help you do that if you can bear them in mind, right? Pretty simple universal principles. If you can bear those in mind, you're going to make better decisions, or you're going to be able to ideate more effectively, or you're going to be able to identify your problems, you know, in exactly the same way that every profession uses the principles of its domain. Mm. What I realized after that book came out was that that works pretty well if you're in a fairly narrow specialism, right? Mm. Like designing customer experiences or interfaces or civil engineering or whatever. Mm-hmm. But then when you start to look at an organization, you're dealing with lots of different domains that have to come together, right? Mm. So now really you're in the world of systems. And when you're dealing with systems, really you're always making trade-offs, aren't you? Mm-hmm. I mean, any business owner knows this. You can you know, invest in the latest new technology, for example, right? But making that investment is going to have implications for your, maybe for your cash flow or for your profitability in the short term, right? Or you can, you know, try and cut costs to be more profitable, yep, but customer service might suffer, or you might find that things get a bit ragged around the edges because, you know, you're trying to do too much with too little kind of thing. You're always making trade-offs when you're dealing with systems. Mm. So my second book was really about trying to give people a way of thinking about their business as a system and identify what the kind of constraint points were that were limiting their performance. Think about what we'd call the second order effect of a decision. So if I change this, how does it affect everything else
down the road? Yeah.
And also like which are our kind of force multipliers or biggest growth opportunities? Is it getting more customers? Is it getting current customers to spend more or come more often? Is it that our people don't know about us and awareness is too low? Is it that our like people are unsatisfied because our customer service is bad or our product's no good or whatever it is? So it gave people a kind of way to see their business as an interconnected whole. Now, what I learned from that and then operating all of that in practice, and this is where I finally get to answer your question, was that when you look at a business as a system and you look at the factors that affect your success, you start to realize that you don't really control them. Like you don't control what your competitors do.
No.
You don't control how the law or regulations change. You don't control what new technologies might come along. You don't control macroeconomic events. You don't control the spread of plagues, right?
Or pandemics.
Or anything like that. And with the help of my co-author, who I must say is really my kind of mentor who taught me all of this stuff, which I was, you know, starting to realize on my own entrepreneurial journey with kind of good timing in that regard, is that as soon as you start talking about the future, whether your aspiration is to kind of innovate, whether your aspiration is to start a new business from scratch, whether your aspiration is to diversify, whether your aspiration is to grow, like whatever it is that you're trying to do that's in the future, you're confronting uncertainty.
Yes.
Right? Like it's irreducible. And that fundamental, like realization A, if you like, set off a cascade of other realizations as a consequence, right? Which was like, one of which is that if you were to stop and think about it, you'd realize that your relationship with uncertainty has profound implications for just about every single aspect, not just of your business, but of your life.
Yes.
Like how you think about failure, whether you consider something to be a failure is a function of your relationship with uncertainty. Was this a lesson or was this a failure?
Mm.
Right? How you think about your management style, how you think about leadership, how you think about trying new things, how whether you have the courage to try new things, frankly. All of this stuff is somehow colored or shaped by your relationship with uncertainty. And that's not something that a lot of us consciously stop and think about, perhaps, or it's not something that we consider. But I would say, especially having done the research for this book and spent a fair amount of time with entrepreneurs and business owners and investors during the research, your relationship with uncertainty is probably the single biggest determinant of your commercial success, right? So that's a huge... that's a huge realization.
Mm.
And the other realization is that if you look at formal business education and you look at business textbooks and you look at theories that take hold and management methods and models and frameworks that take hold, and you think about them through this lens, you realize that there's not really a lot of thought about uncertainty. Or if there is, it's that people want to sell you the opposite.
Mm.
Right? People are trying to sell you certainty. If you follow my method, you will not fail.
Mm.
Or they don't even really acknowledge the inherent kind of randomness and unpredictability of the world. And they often don't really acknowledge this connection that every kind of entrepreneur, I think, instinctively understands, this connection between a willingness to take risks and the size of the payoff that you get.
Mm.
Venture capitalists could very easily invest in, like, village florists and tire shops, you know, businesses that were less likely to fail than the ones that they do invest in. The reason they invest in the ones that they invest in, which carry a high risk of failure, is because in the unlikely event that they don't fail, they generate
huge
10,000x, whatever it is, return on investment.
Mm.
So people who are going through life trying to not fail, if that's your mindset, that is not the mindset that is going to set you up for great success, right? It's not the same thing. Not failing and succeeding massively aren't on the same spectrum. And the decision-making methods and protocols and approaches that you take are very, very different. So I'm aware that's a pretty long-winded answer, but I think it's important for people, you know, even if they stop listening to the podcast right now, because I've already driven them insane, like even if they stop now, at least I have sowed the seed that your relationship with uncertainty is something that you should consciously think about. It's something you should try and work on. It's something you should try and shape. And it's something that is either an advantage or it's something that is perhaps inhibiting you. And I speak as somebody who has, you know, been greatly inhibited for years, frankly, by my own relationship with uncertainty, which is why one of the reasons perhaps why I feel so passionately about this topic.
It's really interesting, and you've given me a couple of really interesting segues into different conversational threads, and I'd like to just talk about the relationship with uncertainty, because you're quite right. I don't think many people would stop and think about, you know, what's my relationship with uncertainty? Maybe they're aware that sometimes they feel afraid when they're making a decision or when they're having to step into something unknown, but how does one actually quantify their relationship with uncertainty? How do you kind of go through that process and go, well, how do I think and feel about uncertain times or stepping into decision making or whatever it is when the future is inherently unknown? How do you quantify that relationship? How do you put some parameters around that?
That's a very good question. I'm not sure I would necessarily say it's about quantifying it. I think it would be kind of about tuning into how you think and feel and respond in certain situations, right? So a big one would be that I think everybody has a particular relationship with is like fear of failure.
Mm.
You know, so that's something where some people have a very enlightened attitude to it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're like, well, if you don't try, you know, you can't succeed.
Mm.
And if you fail trying, you'll learn something and then you're more likely to succeed versus people who are like, well, as long as I don't try, I can't fail. So I'm just not going to try anything.
Yeah.
You know, which would be a kind of a debilitating attitude to failure. And of course, by the way, I'm talking about general stuff here. I'm not talking about like medical procedures.
Yeah,
or,
yeah, no, I totally get it. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Back
totally
to the point.
Context, yeah.
Your relationship with failure is a huge one, right? How comfortable you are taking action where you don't know what the outcome will be. Like most of us inherently know that if we go to a party, we don't know who we're going to meet, and we don't know what the outcome of meeting those people will be. We might make a great friend. We might make a romantic partner. We might stump. Like we have no idea.
Yeah.
Right? But we do know that if we don't go to the party, none of those things happen.
Yes.
Right. So we instinctively understand that. Right. So most of us instinctively understand that what matters most in life decision making is not what's my upside and how can I guarantee it.
Mm.
It's what's my downside and is it acceptable.
Mm.
So you know that there's very little downside to going to the party, even if you don't know what the upside is going to be. But most of us have been kind of brainwashed in our business decision-making to invert that instinctive way of behaving and say, I need to set an achievable, realistic, defined, quantifiable upside, and then I need to implement a plan that will guarantee that I accomplish it. And, you know, that's how people end up are encouraged to make decisions. Well, there are problems with that. There are very obvious problems with that, which is that guaranteeing a return on investment is
doesn't work
almost always bollocks.
Yeah,
you know, like it just never works out like the spreadsheet says.
No,
and that's not how entrepreneurs make decisions.
No.
They make decisions the opposite way. They work on this basis of affordable loss. They say, how much could I comfortably afford to spend to see whether this idea works? Which limits their downside, limits their financial risk, while exposing them to potentially unlimited upside, right? So we've been kind of conditioned to set these smart goals. Everything needs to be specific. Everything needs to be attainable. Everything needs to be very clear. Everything needs to be measurable. And the consequence of that is that we kind of lower our sights to incrementalism.
Mm.
And if we can't put in place a perfect strategy or plan where we've foreseen all the likely obstacles that we've done, we've done all our analysis and planning and everything, we don't do it, right? There's all sorts of different aspects of our relationship with uncertainty that shape our decisions in ways that we're probably not even really aware of, you know?
In the past, I've had to be very aware of my relationship with uncertainty. I am aware of my relationship with uncertainty. I'm probably like a lot of people, we try and maximize certainty where we can, but life is inherently uncertain. I don't know what's going to happen when I walk across the road, for example. You know, life is uncertain. We're always seeking certainty and people sell certainty. And one of the things that I'm probably known for is getting on my bandwagon a little bit is I get a little bit frustrated when I hear surefire, guaranteed, silver bullets, you know, seven steps to blah, blah, blah. That kind of guarantee. Now, people market that way probably because it works, but why does it work so well? And how do we, as the recipients of that marketing, need to just treat that marketing and just kind of have a healthy dose of not necessarily cynicism, but maybe a little bit of skepticism around that as well?
Yeah, this is a really good question, and it's go into it in some depth in the book, but we have you know, our brains kind of evolved for a slightly different set of circumstances to the one that most of us find ourselves in right now. I think we evolved for a harsher, less kind of stable environment, but where threats were perhaps more obvious. And all of these instincts we have, like loss aversion, the halo effect, which is a really pernicious bias in business. I don't know if you know that one.
Yep.
And all of these other kind of phenomena served us very well. they probably in myriad ways continue to serve us very well today. But we live now in societies and economies and everything where we're basically all part of massive, complex adaptive systems, which are nested within other systems. The problem is that we don't really, as a species, have an innate feel for things like exponentiality or randomness or anything like that. So, like, one of the things I explain in the book is that one of the biggest causes of uncertainty in the world is human error.
Yes.
Because we're all making mistakes all the time. And anyone who's done anything pretty much will tell you that the number of wrong ways of doing things massively outweighs the number of right ways of things. And one of the examples that I give that kind of shows how, like, we're just not very good at doing this kind of mathematics, and I'm particularly bad at it. If you have a bolt with eight nuts screwed on it in a particular order, numbered 1 to 8, there's only one way that they can go on in the correct order. I ask people, how many incorrect ways are there that you can put them on? And some people say, like, I don't know, 60 or 20 or something. It's over 41,000. Yeah, we don't really have an innate feel for how much uncertainty there is in the world because our brains are constantly trying to screen it out. Like, the classic one is the hindsight bias, where when events unfold, of course, we predicted it all along. Like, it was obvious to us afterwards. And that's really funny because when you look at, like, startups in particular and innovations and successful businesses, once they're successful, of course it's obvious why they were successful. But until they are, everyone thinks they're a fucking moron.
Well, it's really interesting because I've got a friend of mine who's a financial guy, and he does a lot of work with our community, and he's very fond of saying, the guy that stands up on the TV news at night with his pinstripe suit on, pontificating about what's going to happen with the markets or trying to explain why the markets did what they did, if you listen carefully to what they're saying, they'll come up with some bullshit excuse every single time or bullshit reason.
Well, exactly.
Right. But they're saying it with authority, and that authority seems to convey that they know what they're doing. And I was talking to my friend Mike about this, and I said to him, so why is it that we buy into it? And his comment to me was really quite illuminating, and I'll get your take on it. He said, because, Jesse, uncertainty scares the crap out of most people because they don't like to know that no one really knows what's going to happen with the financial markets today, tomorrow, yesterday. And no one really likes to kind of think that, my goodness, there's a whole lot of randomness in the world. People like to think that we're operating in some kind of orderly sense of doing things because it gives them peace of mind around that. And I'm just curious if you have a perspective or a thought around that exercise that Mike was explaining.
I think he's definitely right. I think a lot of people cling to the idea of certainty like a limpet to a rock.
Yeah.
But I think that's because we haven't really been taught how to think properly about uncertainty. And I think that actually, and of course our brains are kind of wired a certain way, but I've, like, through a series of kind of, I guess, thought experiments, you know, you can, I think, change people's perspective on it. So, but in order for events to be certain, right, if for events to be certain, they need to be predictable, right?
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about the same thing.
Yep.
So we want to be able to predict what's going to happen. Well, if we're all connected together, right, like we are, fabric of society kind of thing, in order for events to be predictable, you would need to be predictable.
Mm.
And that would mean that you had no free will.
Yes.
Like, as soon as you decided to do something that you wanted to do that wasn't the path that was ordained for you by whatever this stabilizing force was, you would be injecting uncertainty into the world.
Yes.
And then you start to realize, well, hang on a second then. Actually, without uncertainty, there is no opportunity. The fact that the future is not set in stone, the fact that the future is unwritten, basically means that we get to be the ones to create it.
Yes.
We can do new things. We can change the direction of our lives. We can create things. We can try things. And that's exciting, right? If everything was certain, we would have no say over our lives, and progress would literally grind to a halt. But I think people need to understand that uncertainty is literally the birthplace of all opportunity, because anything could happen and we get to make it happen.
So in that respect, having agency over your own life means you need to get get comfortable with uncertainty, right? If you want to have any degree of agency over your own life and to be able to write that future for yourself, we've got to then inherently embrace uncertainty. And I wanted to talk to you then about making decisions in an inherently uncertain world, because one of the things I'm always fascinated by is the relationship, or I guess the concept of probability versus possibility. And I suspect as you make your decisions, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I'm thinking that, you know, if you're a venture capitalist and all the rest of it, you're looking at probabilities rather than possibilities, or at least you're looking at both. You're not just kind of looking at one side of the equation. You've got to have some degree of probability in there, I'd imagine.
Well, let me start by saying there's obvious due diligence that you can make with most decisions.
Sure.
Right. So it's not, well, let's just do anything because who knows.
Hmm.
But the problem with the world is that, and I say this kind of in the book, if everything was completely random, we wouldn't feel comfortable leaving the house and we wouldn't feel comfortable staying in it either.
Yes.
Right? Like if everything was completely random, the world would be it would be unlivable.
Mm.
The problem is that the world is just about orderly enough that we think it's predictable when it isn't.
Mm-hmm.
That's the problem.
Yep.
Right? That's the problem. So there are some things that are knowable. There are definitely some things that are reliable, and the problem with those, though, is that they're what kind of investors call priced in.
Mm.
Right? So if they're knowable and they're predictable, they don't confer any real advantage.
Yep.
Like knowing what time the sun is going to come up tomorrow is knowable, right? I hope.
Yeah.
But that doesn't offer you any advantage in business. The problem is that the advantages in business come from basically you knowing you're right when everyone else thinks you're wrong, right?
Yep.
You're looking for a kind of non-consensus worldview, and non-consensus brings with it uncertainty. It brings with it friction in teams. It brings with it disagreement. It brings with it people who love ideas and people who hate them. It brings like all of those,
yep,
all those things together. But to go back to the point though, there are knowable things.
Mm-hmm.
And you should aspire to know the things that are knowable.
Yep.
Right? This is why my first book was about principles, because there are principles that work. There are like methods that allow for consistent success in dentistry and in everything else, right? So you need to know your rudiments and you need to know your technique. So it's not about saying, God, anything could happen, so let's just try.
Yeah.
Where there are knowable risks, you want to know them. Where there is research that can be done to help inform your decisions, you should do it. The problem is that we can't really, if we're talking about innovations or ideas for the future, we can't know. So what we need to do is avoid being deluded by the caliber of our analysis or strategy.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And what we need to do is find ways to test our assumptions at low cost.
Yes.
Right? This is really what it comes down to. The last thing that we want to do is craft an elaborate strategy on paper based on off-the-shelf reports and readily available data and commit 100% to our plan because, you know, there's this Yiddish proverb that says, we plan, God laughs.
I've heard that,
And as they say in the military, like, no plan survives first contact with the enemy.
Mm.
The enemy in this case being the market.
Mm-hmm.
So what we need to do is find ways to test our ideas at low cost and incrementally, typically by running experiments and actually seeing what happens in the real world, right? This is why entrepreneurs are so fixated, like, not on does it work on paper, but does it work in practice?
Mm.
This is why we have this concept of like the MVP, which has kind of been bastardized and messed around and jargonized and everything. But the whole idea is we can't know. So before we optimize, before we overinvest, before we take a massive commitment, we need to work out whether this idea has legs. And that's where this whole concept of affordable loss comes in. How much? And, you know, affordable loss for Apple might be,
$1 billion.
I don't know. Affordable loss for me, sure as hell isn't.
Yeah.
But you can still run experiments within your resources. And then the key is to have a mindset of being open-minded and adaptable and being curious and just trying to learn and then iterate and develop and refine and test your key hypotheses and see whether they hold water. And then once you've got traction with something, then you go in hard, right, to capitalize on the opportunity.
Yeah.
Then you go hard and fast. This is one of the things that I find quite interesting, actually, is that if you look at the behaviors of expert entrepreneurs, you'd think that they'd be like risk-taking kind of cavalier types.
Mm.
And if you look at the behaviors of typical kind of corporate managers, you'd think that they would be very risk-averse.
Mm.
And actually, what you find sometimes is that they're the opposite way around.
Yeah. Is it because of consequences? Is it because the managers... consequences aren't as great potentially as the entrepreneurs whose real money is involved? Is there a reason for that, or is it just because of a mindset issue?
I think skin in the game is a huge part of it.
Yep.
Yeah, if it's not your money, fine. I think skin in the game is a big part of it. But I think another part of it is just putting too much faith in data analysis and strategy and not enough effort into seeing if things work in the real world.
Yeah.
You know, it's easy to make things look good on paper and fall in love with your ideas.
Yeah.
It's really, but it takes courage and open-mindedness and a willingness to be wrong and to fail to actually run a real-world experiment and report back. And there's a connection here just before we move on, right, that I think is really important. If we have invested our time and energy in developing a very thorough strategy based on very thorough data gathering and data analysis, and we're wrong, to many people, that is perceived or interpreted as an indictment of their ability. We gathered the data, we did the research, we ran the analysis, we came up with a plan. If it doesn't work, it's on us, right? It's an indictment of our ability, which is why so many people get defensive about their plans. It stems from this relationship with uncertainty. Basically, what you're doing is you're trying to get to certainty in that example. If you're going into it going, well, you know, it's just my best guess.
Mm.
I'm trying. I've got an idea that I think is good. I've done enough research that I think it's not a mad idea. Why don't we find a cheap way to test this out and see? Oh, I learned something here. Oh, turns out that that bit was good, but this bit maybe was not so good. Okay, so let's change it. It changes your entire psyche. It changes your entire mindset and approach when you start thinking about controlling your downside versus trying to guarantee an upside, right? And those are the kind of big, big differences between ROI-driven employees in large organizations and entrepreneurial types.
I wanted to ask you about absolutism for a second, and I don't know if this is part of your thinking and research as well, but... one of the things I'm curious to understand, I have a particular aversion to binaryism. You know, things are either good, bad, black, white, success, failure. But I wanted to ask you about what actually success means, if there is such a definition, or at least what your research has shown. Because one of the things that I find, going back to the relationship with uncertainty, is unless it works out to the letter exactly as the plan predicted, then some people see that as failure. And I wanted just to get your perspective on taking the lessons of that could be, you know, if things do go badly or not as planned, the lessons could be seen as the success. I wanted to ask you, in your experience, having worked with lots of entrepreneurs, how they see success, how you see success, so that some people might get a little more comfortable with that relationship with uncertainty.
Yeah, this is a really fascinating topic. So my favorite decision-making model,
mm-hmm,
it's called 10-10-10.
Okay.
When I need to make a big decision, I ask myself how I'm going to feel about it in 10 minutes, how I'm going to feel about it in 10 months, and how I'm going to feel about it in 10 years.
Mm.
And that's helped me a lot in a lot of different circumstances, mostly because if I think, like, I'm always looking to the long term anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm like, well, this is going to suck in 10 months, but... you know, in 10 years, it's going to be great. Then that's the decision that I make. And that's got me through a lot of decisions in my personal and professional life. But the point is, and I think this is a hugely important point, time changes everything.
Yes.
Right? A situation that we think is fucking awful can, in the future, be perceived as a real positive inflection point in the trajectory of our life or our career. right? The things that are often seen as our biggest setbacks or stumblings or failures are often a catalyzing agent for a bigger, better life experience or career experience later on. Like I've failed and messed things up so many times, and often it has, you know, in the fullness of time, transpired to a better outcome than I could have imagined. So, you know, time has a kind of alchemical nature to it in terms of our perception of events and in terms of how things really shake out for us. So I'm with you. I don't believe in this kind of absolutism of this is a success or this is a failure, because we're learning all the time, and sometimes the knowledge may seem useless, and then a year later we suddenly need it. Sometimes we meet people and 5 years later they come out of the woodwork and they become a client or a customer or a business partner or whatever.
Yeah,
it's the element of time really that determines whether something is a success or a failure. I also think, and again, I'm like a broken record here, it's a little bit, it comes back to this relationship with uncertainty, but the answer to pretty much everything is, well, it depends.
That's so true.
Like, I mean, it just really is. I think in business, people are like, how do I grow? It depends.
Yeah.
How do I build my brand? It depends. How do I make more money? It depends. Is this a good investment? It depends. Like, I think that we're so seduced by this kind of binary thinking or even the idea that there is one right answer.
Yeah.
Like, and that really frustrates me. It's one of my many frustrations about, like, I'm not going to spend too long on my soapbox here, but it's one of my big frustrations about the education system. Almost all of the work that we do at school, at least when I was at school, there's a right answer and a wrong answer, and you show your working and they give you points, and it's like, this is the right answer, this is the wrong answer. The real world is not like that.
No.
It's not even remotely like that. You know, also at school, we're like, you've got to be a good all-rounder. We want a straight A student. That's like the thing that everybody wants to be, as a straight A student. Then you get into the real world and you realize that what you want is like an A star, star, star in one thing, two Bs and Fs in everything else, because someone else is better than you at them and you'd rather delegate.
Yeah.
Right. So that you get the benefit of everybody's genius or everybody's talents or individual brilliance. Right. Like, my business partner and I have very, very different strengths and weaknesses. Like, if I tried to be as good at him, as good as he is at the things that he's good at, there's no hope. I just, why bother? Right. So, like, even from a very early age, we're not really being taught how to think critically. We're not really being taught how to think in systems. There's no school level education for that. And we're not taught how to think about uncertainty. And, you know, we take our mental models from childhood and we take them into adulthood with us. And unless you're kind of sufficiently open-minded or curious enough or malleable enough, I guess, that you continue to educate yourself and learn and grow and develop. But yeah, like, everything depends. This is a very frustrating situation for a lot of people, but I don't trust anybody who thinks that they have definitive answers that work all the time. And I definitely don't trust people unless I've seen them change their mind at some point.
I think it's really interesting, isn't it? And this is perhaps a reflection on me getting a little bit older. What I've come to realize as I've gotten older is the older I get, the less I'm certain of. And when I was younger, I was strident in my opinions and I was very black and white in my thinking. And as I've gotten older, I've had to review a lot of previously held assumptions, previously held views, and kind of go, you know, maybe there's just a lot more unknown than known, and maybe I've just got to be humble enough to realize I don't know as much as I thought I did.
I've got to tell you, the best thing, I've said this so many times, but the best thing about writing my first book when I was 28 was that I already knew everything.
Yes, exactly right.
And it's only as I've got older and, like, done book two, book three, read a good 500 or so,
yeah,
tried a ton of things, messed a ton of things up. I'm like, oh, maybe I don't really know as much as I thought I did.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's a good sign, though. It's good to change your mind. It's good to learn. It's good to realize that you're wrong. It's good to be humble. And it's good, and it stops you making stupid decisions. You know, it's self-doubt to a point is healthy, right?
I think self-doubt is a useful tool in the right dose.
It's an additive, not a fuel.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, totally. I think, yeah, too much self-doubt obviously inhibits any progress, but a little bit of self-doubt where you're questioning things, getting perhaps other perspectives is really useful. You mentioned something a little earlier, which was a great quote, which was, no battle plan survives first contact with the enemy.
Right, yeah.
And I really like that quote, and I've heard that quote as well. It begs the question of why bother planning, right? And of course, we still plan, we still go through forming, you know, analyses, et cetera, et cetera. I wanted to ask you where the value in planning comes from your perspective. If we understand that uncertainty is inherent in anything future-based, and yet we're still planning, where is the value in that planning? Obviously, how do we kind of plan as thoroughly as we can, but also not hold on to it so tightly that it becomes crippling?
Yeah, again, this is a really, really good question. So thank you for that. So I think the value of planning or having a plan is that the act of preparing it allows you to make your assumptions and hypotheses explicit so that they can be tested.
Mm-hmm.
And when you know what those things are, you have a context for learning.
Yeah.
You know, if you ask any like serious market researcher, they will say all research should be hypothesis driven. If you don't have a hypothesis, it's not really research.
Yeah.
You're trying to validate or invalidate a series of assumptions, right? So when you have a plan, what you're really doing, the act of planning, at least in my mind, is you're like sending, I'm sure somebody's got some amazing quote about this that I'm not articulate enough or whatever to pull out of the hat, but it's something like, we send our thoughts ahead to die in our stead, right? So you're effectively able to, and like, consider how future events might unfold and what you would do in that circumstance in the abstract without having to commit to it. So planning allows you to work with other people, to share your worldview, to understand theirs, to anticipate what might happen, and to make an educated and informed guess with a degree of confidence. That's what it allows you to do. It doesn't allow you to guarantee an outcome, but it does allow you to say, we took what we believed was the most prudent course of action, given the information that we had available to us and given our understanding of the circumstance, right? And so it allows you to think through things, anticipate them. And in so doing, of course, it forces you to reflect on what are we actually trying to achieve? Do we even know that? You know, what outcome are we actually aiming for? Do we even know that? Often, in fact, projects that I work on, those things aren't known.
Yeah.
Right? That's the value of planning. The value of planning isn't that it determines our result. The value of planning is that it sets the context within which we can learn, and hopefully things go according to plan.
You know, I've certainly in my younger years been guilty of seeking a paint by numbers exercise. You know, if I get all the little number threes and I paint them orange, and I get the number fours and paint them green, I'm going to end up with a beautiful picture of something, and it's going to look just is. But of course, the beauty of a plan is it's organic. And a paint by numbers exercise, of course, means we are trying to create that certainty. We're trying to create almost like a stamped out version of what our future should look like without kind of having the flexibility to adjust and iterate as we go. So I really appreciate the notion of sending your thoughts out there into the world, and I can't remember the quote exactly, send the thoughts ahead so they may die in our stead, I think is a great quote.
I'm pretty sure someone very smart said something similar who wasn't me. I think I stole that from somebody who was a psychologist.
It's yours. We're gonna give it to you. We're going to attribute it to you. So,
well, the other thing is, basically on that point, actually, like if you look at strategy in the kind of sense that Richard Rummel, who wrote this wonderful book, Good Strategy, Bad Strategy, explains it, but he basically says that a strategy is an acknowledgement of a key challenge or opportunity,
yeah,
a guiding policy for how we feel we should approach it, and a set of specific actions that we would take as a consequence. There's very little downside to having a strategy, you know, and I think that that intellectual exercise of thinking through that is very, very good. But we also need to acknowledge that the amount of uncertainty that we're facing, it really does depend. Are we launching a startup where we're trying something that's never, ever been done before, where the technology doesn't even exist or work or whatever? Or are we trying, are we following a tried and true business model where we're like Starbucks and we're just opening a new store?
Yes.
In the next neighborhood, right? Can this thing that we're doing be systematized and turned into a procedure? Or is the number and shape of variables that we're contending with make that impossible, right? Everything is contextual, you know? So I think that point kind of bears repeating as well, that this stuff matters, you know?
Matt, I wanted to firstly thank you for your time today. It's been a really fascinating conversation. I've got one last question I'd like to just round out with, because in your first book, you spoke about 10 principles around customer experience. And I think you made a point earlier about principles can be, you know, guiding lights for us along the journey. As you've gone through your own entrepreneurial journey, as you've seen others go through theirs, in a world of uncertainty, what do you see as perhaps some of the principles, not the dead set, you know, do this and you'll get that kind of thing. I don't mean that, but what are the guiding principles that you have seen to be useful and thought-provoking and productive to help your thinking in an uncertain world?
Well, I mean, the book goes into this in great detail, so a little bit of a plug for that. I think the first thing is to make sure that you have, I would say there are three major areas to focus on, right? The first is your mindset. You need to, whether it takes years of therapy or whether it's just natural to you or whatever, you need to have a healthy and enlightened relationship with failure. If failure is even the right word for not getting what we want straight away. You need to be extremely tenacious, because when things are a numbers game, your numbers might not come up straight away. So you need to keep rolling the dice, right? You need to work on your tenacity, and you need to be open-minded. Many people come unglued because they can't change their mind. They can't adapt. They can't respond to feedback. They can't learn. They're not open-minded, and it stunts their growth. So those are three kind of key elements mindset-wise.
Okay.
Another ironclad principle, which I think is probably the golden rule in life, is go through life being a host, not a guest. Ooh. This is hugely, hugely important. Because if you go through life being a host, not a guest, you accumulate social capital, right? You put other people together. You build goodwill with people. You build your reputation. Yeah. And you start to become a magnet for opportunity. Most people are going through life saying, what's in this for me? How can I profit from this? How do I get what I want right now? That it doesn't work. The way that works is just to sincerely, with no expectation of reward, to go through life being a host. And if you just think about what that means in the context of a party, attending to people's individual needs, putting people together who might benefit from knowing one another, making people feel welcome and valued, boom.
Yeah.
Hugely, hugely important. The last thing is on pragmatics around business, you have to embrace the idea of affordable loss and start asking, what's my downside, rather than trying to lock in a guaranteed upside.
Yeah.
If you can do those things in a nutshell, you know, you're ahead of 99% of people on the planet, I'd say.
Matt, been a really interesting and fascinating conversation with you. Just in relation to your books, the first being The 10 Principles Behind Great Customer Experiences, the second being The Grid, which is the decision-making tool for every business, including yours, and the third one, Mastering Uncertainty. We've covered a lot around uncertainty today, and I know the other two books can be really useful to complete people's education. Where's the best place that they can get a copy of those books, and how can they find out more about you and your work?
Yeah, my website is matt-watkinson.com. So there's that. I'm pretty active on LinkedIn as well. I'm pretty easy to find. Bald head, vacant expression. Matt Watkinson. The books are available pretty much everywhere, certainly in Australia or...
Jump on Amazon or wherever,
And on Audible and Kindle and iBooks and Semaphore Books or whatever, you know.
Basically everywhere.
Yeah, they're everywhere.
Yeah, everywhere.
Yeah.
really good to talk to you. Fascinating conversation. For a Brit living in LA, mate, you must be having a good time over there, and it's showing in the work that you're doing, which I think is really fascinating, really interesting, and really important too. So long may that continue. And from all of us here at Savvy Dentist, mate, thanks for sharing your thoughts, and thanks for being so thought-provoking, because I think I really appreciate this, because I just love the idea of it depends. I love the idea that nothing is black and white. I love the idea that there are many ways to be right. And I love the fact that you're embracing that uncertainty. So thank you for sharing that so freely and openly with us, mate. And look forward to talking to you soon.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to the Savvy Dentist podcast. For more episodes, go to drjessegreen.com/savvydentist. And to discover how to build a high-performance dental practice, visit drjessegreen.com and download the free report.